All right, when Pastor Rob said that our next sermon series was going to be focusing on the little known characters in the Bible and the lessons they offer us, the story of the paralyzed man being lowered through the roof by four friends was the very first story I thought of. I love finding God in people, places, and situations where we least expect God to be. And I don't expect people in the ancient world to be so loving and kind towards people with disabilities. So when I was young and I heard this story, I think my Sunday school teachers probably wouldn't have really talked about the friends that much at all. And if they did, they probably would have been pointing out how God had worked with the friends to be helpful to someone who needed it. But over the years, I have come to understand that there's something much deeper, much richer happening here. The presence of God is illuminated within these friends by the way they hold each other in relationship. And it is at least a little bit of the reason why this story is one of my favorites. But what exactly was it that illuminated the presence of God within them? Was it how they treated the man with a disability with kindness? Was it their friendship? Maybe it was their stick-to-itiveness, their determination to see it through to the very end. I was not sure at first. I did know one thing, though. I felt that all translators, all theologians, at least have one part of this story wrong. And that is that they see four friends. There are clearly five. It is fundamentally important to the story to understand this, because without understanding how valuable to them their friend was, nothing they do makes sense. As we move through the story this morning together, I hope you become as convinced as I am that these were five people who deeply loved one another and were committed to one another. I believe that the four friends who helped the fifth did not do so because they themselves saw themselves as rescuers, liberators, or redeemers. Nor are they do-gooders who rushed in to correct the wrongs and woes of another's life. There is simply too much happening and too much at stake for that to be all that is going on. They were not offering help because they pitied the fifth, not because they were somehow holier than the fifth man or more deserving. They humbled themselves. They humbly offered their ableness in compassion and kindness. And in doing so, they demonstrated what it means to be in relationship, not only with one another, but with God as well. They saw this man as valuable because he was their friend every bit as much as they were his. If they did anything extraordinary at all, at least in their eyes, it was that at a time when being immobile, paralyzed, and disabled was considered not only a burden on one's family, but also punishment for sins. These men looked beyond the physical capabilities and saw value and purpose within. They saw him for who he was, in as much the same way as God sees the value and purpose in each of us. And because they were aware of his value, they committed themselves to finding Jesus and to seeing this search for healing through till the very end, at no small cost to themselves, and ultimately at a cost to others as well. So I believe this first lesson they teach us is that others cannot and should not be defined by what they can or cannot do, but by who they are within. And when you take the time to get to know someone and begin to really care about them, you see them, you are filled with compassion and understanding for them, and you value the relationship you have with them. You even honor the differences from you without lauding over them your own abilities, whether they be physical abilities, social economic abilities, or even positions of power and authority. That lesson in and of itself is sufficient, more than enough lesson for one story that is contained within just 12 brief verses, especially in a world that is too often failing to be inclusive of people who are physically, developmentally, and mentally differently abled than most others. But as I dug deeper, I discovered the story contains many more lessons than that. To do that, I used a spiritual practice developed by St. Ignatius that helps us to creatively visualize the scene within the scripture. He believed that by opening ourselves up to Jesus' teaching in this way, we would gain deeper understanding and connection to the scripture. Hundreds of years have passed since St. Ignatius began to practice and teach this form of prayer, and there's been much research done since then in how we learn and how we develop socially, individually, and spiritually. I think St. Ignatius knew intuitively what research tells us today. We can connect more deeply when we experience things at a sensory level, meaning that when we experience them through our seeing, our hearing, our taste, our touch, and even our smell. Now, obviously, we can't travel back in Capernaum and witness the story as it's happening to know the actual tastes and sounds at all. But we can use what we know to visualize in our minds about what is happening. So I want to share with you a little bit about Capernaum and what it was like to live there. So I have some slides I'm going to share with you. So this is a slide of Israel. You can kind of tell, I wanted to show you the whole Israel slide because I wanted you to be able to see, maybe just because it's the Lenten season, I wanted you to be able to see a good bit of what was the territory that Jesus' ministry actually took place in. But Capernaum is the top blue arrow on the Sea of Galilee. It is on the northwest coast of the Sea of Galilee, and there's only a couple of towns just a little bit further north that Jesus actually makes it to. And the town on the bottom, at the bottom blue arrow, is Jerusalem, and that's almost as far south as he goes. Bethlehem's a little bit souther, a little bit further south. Souther, that's my own language there. So that was what I wanted you to see in that particular slide. The second slide is just a picture of Capernaum. Great, lovely. It's a great time for the slides to do this. The second picture is just a picture of Capernaum on the kind of the coastal view of Capernaum. So it gives you an idea of what Capernaum looks like from kind of standing like out in the middle of the water, maybe like on a boat, and kind of seeing what it looks like. It has a lot of, for those of you who are here, there's a lot of piers that are coming out into the water, and you can just see that the housing is kind of up towards the coast. And maybe what's important here is that the whole area along the coastal region is going to be kind of like the business district. So as they get off the boats, they're going to go sell their fish to either people or to businesses that are going to use the fish, and then there's going to be other businesses around those that support the fishing industry as well as life in Capernaum as well. So there are 1,100 people in the city of Capernaum, and to give some reference to this, there are 33,000 people in the city of Gehenna. So this is on average about 2,677 residents per square mile. So if we wanted to have a feel, now Capernaum is bigger than a half a mile square, but if we wanted to have a feel of what it was like, how many people, in terms of how many people, we would take a half mile square of people in Gehenna, and that's how many people were in Capernaum. So the next slide is a slide, I kind of just threw this in for fun. I have to admit to you that I'm a little bit, archaeology is my dream job, so I kind of threw this one in just for fun, just because I liked it. But this boat is called the Jesus boat. This was a boat that was actually excavated in an area near Capernaum, and it is dated back to the time of Jesus. This is called the Jesus boat because this is most likely, we can't prove that Jesus was ever in this boat, but it was most likely the kind of boat that Jesus both walked out to on the water, as well as the kind of boat that he fell asleep in. And so it just gives you an idea of what kind of boat these men were in. The next slide, which I don't even know if we have any slides working at this point. but the next slide, and when they do get it back up and going, Jay can just kind of go on. As I go on to other things, he can just kind of slowly go through the slides and show you, and I'll just describe what they are. But the next slide is a kind of a picture of Jesus and some of the disciples in a boat like that, so you can get a feel. Because when I look at that Jesus boat, I'm thinking, I can't tell how big it is. I don't know what's going on with that boat. But the next picture will give you a sense of how many people actually fit in the boat and what that boat would have looked like. And I have to tell you, I would not be getting in that boat to go out on the Sea of Galilee and fish. It is not happening for me. So there's the Jesus boat. We're back. Thank you. And there's the boat that they're out on the sea with. So you can imagine what that might be like. Okay? The fifth slide, though. Now, this is where we're getting into something useful in the story. The fifth slide is what a home would look like in Capernaum. It could be that the home would only be one story, but often, especially if they were middle class citizens, they would have two stories homes. And on the first story is actually where the stables for the animals reside. Most of the cooking is happening on the first floor, and there are other tasks that are being done. Like maybe they would clean fish there or skin hides there. They would do work like that that really you don't want up in your living quarters. So they would do work down in that first floor. Then you can see that there's a ladder that goes to the second floor, so probably not steps, although the next slide is going to show you a house with steps. You can go back to the other slide. I'm sorry, I shouldn't have probably mentioned the sixth slide. So you can see that the ladder goes up to the second floor. That's where they slept. And you can't see it from the distance that we're at, but there's actually a loom on that floor as well, so people might do work like that on that floor as well. Then the third floor, there was always access to the roof too, and there is some work that's getting done up there. Maybe food prep, maybe even some cooking somehow might be getting done up there too. The roof is made by laying down beams, which are tree trunks. And so the width of the house is basically the width of a tree trunk often. It's not a lot wider than that. And then what they do is they lay down tree branches or palm tree branches in between the beams. And then on top of that, they lay clay or mud. And then when that clay and mud bakes in the sun, it makes that roof pretty hard. So if you kind of think like the adobe houses out west for the Native American Indians, it's kind of very similar to those. And so those walls, those Native American homes have stayed for hundreds of years at this point. So that's kind of the same idea here. They're going to have that same axe, they're that same durability. But when they go up on the roof, they're often sleeping up there, especially if it's hot. If it's hot weather, they're going to go up there and feel that breeze coming in off the ocean. So I really wanted you to see the picture of the house the most. And then the next slide shows you kind of the house setting in a neighborhood, sort of. And this house does have steps in it. But I had a professor who was actually a New Testament professor, and he was also an archaeologist who'd been on multiple digs, and he felt that the more common house was the one with the ladder, not the steps. So that's an idea of what Capernaum looks like and what these men are experiencing as they arrive with Jesus. So these pictures, I hope, give you an idea of just how difficult and physically demanding the task was to carry another person to this house. You might get a sense of the disappointment they felt, that they might have felt when they found the house already full with people. So full, in fact, that their friend probably had little chance of being healed had they just stayed there at the doorway. They couldn't get in. The doorway was crowded with people, and there are people standing on the outside of the house at this point. Maybe you can also see how difficult it must have been to make the decision to carry him to the roof and destroy the host's home. They weren't just taking away tree branches and laying them to the side. They were chopping away. And as I think about this, I can't imagine that they were doing this with their hands. So I'm guessing that they picked tools up as they went up the ladder, and they're actually crashing through the ceiling. And they're leaving the family, their hosts, exposed without shelter and protection. And they would have understood the strain that this damage would place on the family, and that it was not a decision that they could have taken lightly. I'm certain of that. I believe, though, that the journey that led them to this moment began long ago, when they first made the decision to look past the physical brokenness and see the value within their friend. Once they made that foundational decision, it made it easier the next time when an occasion arose to make a choice in favor of their friend again. And the next time after that, again, it became easier to make that choice in his favor. And this happens again and again until they arrive at this point where they carry their friend to where Jesus is seeking, to where Jesus is seeking his healing. The task to get their friend to Jesus may have been hard, yes, but the decision to bring them there was most likely not a difficult friend, a decision for the friends. They had been choosing him over and over for quite some time. We don't know how far exactly they traveled. It could have been a mile, it could have been a half a mile. It's just that carrying someone else, even when you're sharing that work amongst four people, is not easy work. I think it's safe to say that the decision to do this is only the most recent decision for the benefit of this friend. As I mentioned earlier, only friends who place the value of this friend, of this person potentially above their own well-being, would take these risks and exert this energy. The willingness to carry another for a distance, even a small one, the willingness to take the next step and go to the roof when access any other way was not possible, and their perseverance and the determination suggests that they are committed to this person. They're committed to do this thing all the way through to the end. Committed to seeing him for who he is, not what he can do. Committed to bearing not just the weight of the load, but also the weight and responsibility of their decisions along the way. And committed to making difficult decisions that might cause others more work, problems, strain, or even harm. These are not casual do-gooders. The friend who is paralyzed has great value to them. These are five men who inspire one another, and love one another, and are in a relationship that seems covenantal in nature. I imagine these friends have been together since childhood. These are friends who share in life together. They may have been through much together and are willing to do much more. They have great compassion for the friend, and they see this task as something they must do for him and maybe for one another. This is chesed. This is the Hebrew word for the love with which God loves us. And it's translated as loving kindness. God can love us in no other way but to be kind, generous, and gracious. God has, in fact, promised to love us in this way. We have a covenant with him. What we may not realize about kindness is that kindness is contagious. It's actually scientifically proven. When we see someone doing something kind, it makes us want to take action that is kinder than we might have taken had we not witnessed a kindness being done. And it has inspired these five men to love each other in the same way. This is a reflection of God's love for each of them, and this is an expression of how they see their relationship to God and to one another. Their love and friendship have to be lived out in kindness. Simply put, they've caught the kindness bug and can't help it, and cannot help but spread it as though it were a contagion. Several years ago, I read a book called Eleanor Oliphant is Completely Fine. Eleanor and the characters in the book are pretty everyday kind of people. As we read on, we realize that Eleanor is struggling with something, but we don't know what. She is socially awkward, maybe even a little odd, and she has a scar on her face from a childhood accident, and she doesn't really care about her appearance. She pushes away anyone who might be her friend, using the excuse that they are either intellectually or socially unworthy of her. She does, however, fall in love with a local band singer whom she has never met. Which, of course, is not strange at all. And so in the meantime, she has a new coworker, and she witnesses an act of kindness. And in fact, the coworker drags her into the act of kindness, and so she has to participate in it as well. And I believe that this experience opens her up to this person becoming a new friend for her. And of course, there are more acts of kindness along the way that happen. And as the story moves forward, she even begins to see this person as a friend, but she isn't sure she wants them to be a friend. She remains leery of them, but as you might imagine, the friendship begins a series of changes for her. Remembering this book made me realize that God wants us to see that there is more to this kindness thing than it's simply inspiring the next act of kindness. Yeah, it's wonderful to be kind, and I encourage everybody to do that, or have kindness shown to you. And it's wonderful that it inspires us to be kinder to others, and it's also a great big yes to the idea that kindness could affect changes in the world. But I couldn't shake that there's something more happening here. In his 2017 article, Toward a Life-Giving Christian Spirituality, 10 Guiding Principles, Thomas Hart, a noted psychologist and theologian, lists principle number 8 as, we are neither naturally good nor naturally evil, but immensely malleable and ultimately responsible for our own becoming. He reminds us that throughout the Gospels, Jesus deals with people as though they have free choice. He goes on, in creating us, God creates not so much a person as the raw materials for a person. Our creation continues from birth until death under the influence of our environment and in virtue of our own free choices. The environment contains shaping elements, both constructive and destructive. Environments differ from environments in their proportions of good and evil. Each of our choices paves the way for the next, making a similar choice easier and a different kind of choice harder. Whenever we are, wherever we are, grace, the empowering gift of God's love, is always available to us. Heart is saying that each time we make a good decision, it becomes easier to make the next good decision. And each time we make a bad decision, it becomes easier to make the next bad decision. Whether individually or collectively, these decisions have shaped and mold us. The raw materials God gave us form us as we make these decisions. Each decision we make, taking us closer to the person we are becoming. God is hoping, and actually, God does not even hope at all. He doesn't even play fair. God is constantly at work making it possible for us to embrace something good in all things. And because each time we make a decision that is good in this nature, each time we choose the good over the bad, it makes it easier for us to become all that God has created us to be. Why? Because kindness isn't only contagious in the way we think it is. In other words, it's not just that if I witness you doing something, it will make me want to be kind too. Although that has, like I said, been scientifically proven true. It is also scientifically proven true that this could have a ripple effect within us. And that it is called moral elevation. And it does much more than just spread the kindness from person to person. Scientists are researching and making advancements in understanding that when we witness kindness and become inspired to act in kindness towards others, there's something happening inside us. A chemical reaction that makes us feel pretty darn good. It's that reaction that when we feel warm and we smile because we just did something good for someone, and we want to do it again and again and again. So the contagion God is inspiring is not that we give the kindness bug to others, but that each time we make a decision to be kind, it makes it easier for us to want to do it again. He does not play fair at all. And each time that kindness molds us into who God gave us the raw materials to become. Heart further suggests that when we can't make a decision or take action, or if it's just too tough for us to make a choice that we are sure is good, it might be best if we ask for help. Sometimes the best choice is simply to ask our friends for help. And we can ask by reaching out to those friends or through prayer. Both are good choices. But I want to return to Eleanor Oliphant for just one more moment, because in Eleanor Oliphant is completely fine, it's important to acknowledge that Eleanor was never completely fine, nor was she even sort of fine. She was in full-on crisis mode and didn't realize it. I don't want to ruin the story for you, but Eleanor was dealing with trauma that had happened long, long ago. Trauma she had been unable to face. And she had been making choices all of her adult life. Choices to not take care of herself, choices that left her in seclusion, and even choices to fortify her walls of seclusion, further pushing others away over and over. She made choices to not take care of herself or even be concerned with her own well-being. All it took was for her to let one friend in, just one. And she had the strength to change the way she was making decisions and begin making better ones. It was that one act of kindness early on that sent her down the path that allowed her to let that one friend in. And that one friend made her stronger. So with a little help from Eleanor Oliphant, we see yet another lesson from the five friends. Two are better than one. It's a lesson we see in Ecclesiastes. And Martin Luther King called Ecclesiastes a noble little book. Colette, who is considered sometimes the author of Ecclesiastes, because the book does give him credit for it. However, researchers recognize that because of the literary pattern, it's probably not an actual capture of events that happened, but it's more of a fictional piece of work designed to teach wisdom to young Jewish men. It makes me think of the movie Dead Poets Society, where Robin Williams teaches wisdom to young men in prep school. However, just because its setting is fictional does not mean it's not worthy of being read. It's filled with great wisdoms, and actually many, including myself, take great comfort in the many of its wisdoms. And Colette declares this wisdom gem: two are better than one, because they have a good return for their labor. If either of them falls down, one can help the other up. But pity anyone who falls and has no one to help them up. Also, if two lie down together, they will keep warm. But how can one keep warm alone? Though one may be overpowered, two can defend themselves. A cord of three strands is not quickly broken. So imagine what five strands must do. Colette intuitively knows what the friends on the roof know, and what Eleanor Oliphant finally learned: friends strengthen us. I don't think the five friends saw themselves as destroying a roof. I think they were able to make the decision that did cause damage to a roof because they saw what they were doing as opening up a roof with kindness. The roof was their glass ceiling. They could not get to what they needed without going through it. The only way to be kind to their friend was to begin digging. The lessons that we learn from the five friends who band together to bring out healing for one of them teach us about compassion, perseverance, chesed, or loving kindness, and how it's lived out as a covenantal commitment to those we love, how kindness changes us by shaping and molding us for the good, moving us closer to who we are becoming as much as or more than it helps others. And they teach us about how we are stronger when we let people in. That is a lot to learn from five guys whose story is told in 12 lines and who are mentioned, I believe, only twice. As I wrote this, I was reminded about the team of people who gather weekly at Taylor Springs and bi-weekly at Chestnut Hills, and also the Thursday morning Goodwill team. And there are many here at GC3 that we could think of that serve others in some way, bringing kindness to others, like the garden team, the Women of Hope, the Hope Letters Writing Group, and so many others. I watch you as you talk about your experiences in working with our friends and neighbors in the committee, and sometimes I watch a slight bit of hesitation as you admit that doing these good works makes us feel good. Maybe even feel good about ourselves. We want to do good for the sake of doing good, and we want nothing in return for serving the one who created us and loves us with kindness and grace. We want to do things for others because it helps them and it's the right thing to do. And I do admit that humility is critically important. If we're not humble in the kindness we offer others, it would not be kindness at all. But I want to offer you this. Your kindnesses are decisions that are good. Each time you make these decisions to help someone else, this decision to be kind, you are molding and shaping those raw materials that God gave you to use in your becoming. Remain humble about your kindnesses, yes. But do not push down and minimize and devalue that your kind offerings make you feel good. Allow yourself to catch the kindness bug and do these acts of kindnesses as often as you can. Because each kindness takes you a step towards becoming who God created you to be. And each time you feel good about these decisions, each time you get that warm feeling in your chest and that gentle smile crosses your face and you feel like you've just received a hug, those are the physical proofs that you just moved a little closer to who God created you to become. You are doing good work not just and only for others, but also when you and God, but also for you, and when and God wants that for you. So allow that feeling to be noticed. Take a deep breath and take it all in for that moment. Take the time to realize that the warmth you just felt is you becoming. And I am certain that God is dancing and all the saints in heaven are joining in, not simply because there's a little more kindness in the world, but because all those raw materials God gave you to use in your becoming just moved a little closer to the vision the God of creation has for you. For me, loving kindness, faith, and prayer are expressions of my relationship with God, with the one who is with me always. Faith can mean many things and be expressed in many ways, but ultimately for me, faith in God, just like prayer, is really about what it might make of me. And I want to say, look at what it did for the five. But we never know for sure what that movement in their lives happened after the four. We know only that the one who needed healing was healed because of his faith. His faith that allowed him to believe that he had something worthy to offer four friends, whose kindness towards his friends inspired a friendship that broke open a roof and created this favorite story of mine. As I travel further in my spiritual journey, I come to know more deeply each day that my faith is about me evolving into who God created me to be. I wonder if the five friends realized they were becoming as they opened up that roof with kindness. And I also wonder, am I making all the decisions I can to become what God calls me to be? What roofs should I be opening up with kindness? What decisions is God calling you to make in kindness? What roofs are you already beginning to open with that kindness?